The old world is dying, the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. Today I wanted to take up the issue of Donald Trump's corruption. And yeah, this is actually like an argument against the idea that Donald Trump is descending into senility, as some Democrats are saying. Because I mean, one of the striking things about Donald Trump's evolution is from the first term to the second term is that he's actually gotten like much more bold and imaginative about corruption. Not to say he wasn't corrupt in the first term, but there was a lot of like sort of penny ante stuff with emoluments of having foreign leaders stay at his hotels. And, you know, you're dealing with stuff in the range of like millions, you know, which if you're in the White House, like, you know, you have an opportunity to steal billions. And I think one of the things that one could actually say about Donald Trump is that he has learned that actually like the presidency is worth much more than he had imagined when he was first elected. So to take up all this issue of corruption and what can be done about it and what it says about the larger problem of the United States, of the imperial presidency and of the sort of impunity of the ruling class, I'm very happy to have on my colleague, Chris Lehman, who is also a columnist and editor at The Nation, and who's written about this. So first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jade. It's always a pleasure, even when addressing these grim topics.
Yeah. As I sort of alluded to, I mean, like, you know, like Trump being corrupt is in some ways an old story. But I do actually think that it's maybe worth rehearsing, like, just the sort of startling scale of the sort of corruption and the dollar amounts that are involved. So let's just run through a few of these things so we have a sense of what we're talking about. And I think you did a recent column on the so-called anti-weaponization fund. So what exactly is that?
Well, that is this sort of make-believe legal settlement arising from, you know, what's clearly another of the many meritless legal actions that Trump brings in order to broker these kind of payoffs. And this one, because, you know, it's very much an agitprop kind of fund, was given the sum of $1.776 billion to pay out to victims of, quote, the weaponization of justice, which is a whole other discussion we could have. But principally,
it's a legitimate settlement when the dollar sum arrived at happens to like echo the national anniversary year that you're celebrating.
Yeah, which is a whole other realm of corruption. You know, the preparations for the White House's commemoration of the country's 250th anniversary is a total exercise in graft as well. You know, this is a small, but I think richly symbolic thing is the effort to renovate the reflecting pool outside the Lincoln Memorial, which Trump has bragged erroneously. It turns out that he got someone who had done contracting work on water-based facilities at Mar-a-Lago, which turns out not to be true. And weirdly, what is a first order conflict of interest, right?
It's like a lot of money flowing around for many operations. And so the anti-weaponization fund with this sort of resonant number of $1,776 million, what is that? Why is there like
it arises, you know, from this lawsuit that Trump was bringing against the IRS. Speaking of sort of conflicts of interest, I don't think we've ever had a president sue an agency he presides over for a cash settlement. He was seeking $10 billion in damages because a contractor working with the IRS had leaked his tax returns, which again, the scale of corruption is so mind-boggling, you have to take a step back and realize Trump is suing the government for something that in the modern presidency is a routine disclosure for people holding power, right? We had this kind of tradition of, okay, you're going to seek maximum power in our political system. you should disclose your finances so we can guard against these very kinds of conflicts of interest, right?
Yeah, and as you just suggested, the very idea of a president suing to receive damages for leaks. I mean, like one can imagine, like Richard Nixon, maybe it was a failure on his part that he did not sue the FBI for for the leaks of Deep Throat and received a settlement of billions. Because I mean, like he was clearly damaged.
Did in fact suffer. I think it's an open like. I mean, Trump, what's telling is that after Trump's tax information was leaked, I mean, there was ample evidence of tax evasion and fraud and corruption, which we all just sort of accept as being baked into the Trump model of leadership, right? I don't think he could have alleged there was significant damage to his reputation.
No.
That is his reputation, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing I pointed out in the column I wrote about this fund is, going back to the Nixon presidency and the Watergate scandal, is people tend to forget that the engine of the Watergate, which was only one of a series of executive branch scandals under the Nixon presidency, which involved turning the White House into a covert ops operation to protect the political interests of the White House, that was all done by funds just like this. It came from private sector sources. That's the only real difference. Or it's an AT&T funds of, I think, $44 million or $4 million probably.
Yeah.
In for $70, in which the White House brokered approval of a favorable antitrust decision for AT&T in order to get political bosh. There was the milk fund, where a series of milk cooperatives wanted to evade price controls on milk. And again, the Nixon administration agreed for a lot of money, which they all used. And Watergate is part of this. The committee to reelect the president was also essentially a slush fund to pursue political enemies. So yeah, this is the model. And it's telling to me that half a century ago, this was a huge scandal, cancer on the presidency, and now it's a feature of the presidency 50 years later under Trump.
I mean, one of the big differences also, like, the current slush fund is like much vaster in scale.
Yeah, I went back and did the math using an inflation calculator and all that, and yeah, I think the return, that's where the 44 million figure comes in. That was the revenue that the milk producers got in exchange for their payoff. I forget now exactly how it works out, but I think it's by a factor of 10 or something. Again, it's all public sector money, right? We, the taxpayers, are paying directly. And the other big piece of it is the beneficiaries of the fund are, you know, its legal status is now sort of up in the air. Todd Blanche says it's not going to happen. Trump is still saying it will happen. But the important detail, I think, is that this is all money that would go directly to January 6th protesters or rioters.
Yeah.
Who are already pardoned. And another, Trump's abuse of the pardon power in the second term is off the charts. First day in office, he pardons everyone convicted of crimes relating to the January 6th coup attempt. Many of whom have already gone back as recidivists and committed all kinds of crimes.
Yeah, this is a sort of like a minor crime wave in the United States going on right now. Who Trump released from jail.
I live in D.C., right? And they're actually going to double the deployment of National Guards for this 250th anniversary. But like, Trump pardoned all of these people who menaced and physically assaulted and in some case, in a way that resulted in the deaths of, I think, 6 police officers. So this is why it's so hard to wrap your head around the scale of corruption here, because it is mind-bending, let's say, to have this imperial posturing around, you know, law and order, crime wave in the Capitol, and the most significant crime that's occurred in the last decade in Washington is January 6th.
I mean, that's absolutely, I mean, yeah, basically the president not only has like pardoned the mob that he incited to attack Congress, but is now rewarding them. So how that's compatible with anything like small R Republic, I'm not.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's a really interesting point, because I'm not generally in the camp of students of history who reflexively revere the founders, but it's really important to underline the chief threat you see embodied in the Constitution and the Federalist Papers is the idea that the executive under this new American system of government could become a tyrant. So that's why you have the separation of powers calibrated the way they are, that Congress controls the power of the purse. You don't want that in the presidency, because if you give him a lot of money, he's going to engage in self-dealing.
That's absolutely the case. And
same with war powers, which is a timely subject, because finally Congress has passed a motion to exercise war powers authority over the illegal war in Iran. But this is all of a piece, and this is what I think we've lost under the conditions of the modern imperial presidency, this basic understanding that the kind of most pressing mortal risk to the Republican system of government, small r, in the American system is this runaway presidency. The idea that he, you know, the president, if you give him things like the power to declare war, if you give him sort of access to primary funding streams, it's going to build up into something like the monarchy. And I'm not a fan of the No King slogan. I think it's an evasion of class politics in certain ways. But speaking historically, this is the threat that the drafters of the Constitution understood very clearly. You know, you have to rein in this office of the presidency. The whole idea of a unitary executive, which is the fetish that the right has adopted in legal circles, is simply a fiction. It does not arise from any coherent historical understanding of what the founders were about.
Yeah, no. I think that's absolutely right. And like in terms of foreign policy as well, I mean, it is very striking the degree to which Trump is like openly like, you know, said that his foreign policy is guided by like the sort of business interests that he and his family have in the Middle East. I mean, he gave a speech where he basically said, you know, like Miriam Adelson gave me and her late husband gave me a lot of money, so I rewarded them by making Jerusalem the capital.
The Abraham Accords. I mean, the Abraham Accords basically encodes this model. It's all about business interests being, you know, the leading factor in shaping diplomacy in the
and not just like business interests in the sort of classic American imperialist sense of, you know, like we have like these oil interests and the presidency will carry it, but like actually very specific things where, you know, very wealthy people in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are investors in businesses run by the Trump family and run by Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff and that the whole purpose of American foreign policy is to sort of consolidate.
That's interesting. Absolutely. Yeah. No. And you know, the chief sector in which the Trump family is enriching itself at this moment is through cryptocurrency. You know, they realized something like $5 billion in, I guess you can't even call it paper returns because it's crypto. And it's another thing that, you know, I don't think people understand sufficiently because of all the propaganda around what crypto is. In this context of exchanging, you know, basically political favors for foreign investors, it's a perfect system of bribery. And Witkoff, you know, is one of the chief sort of financial players behind the Trump cryptocurrency. So again, that is just like a first order conflict of interest in the classical Republican sense of things. You can't have, you know, your Middle East guy who's supposed to be running, you know, diplomacy profiting. It's insane. I mean, it's
absolutely no. Okay, so we have like, you know, pretty substantial evidence of really, I think, corruption on like an unprecedented scale. I mean, as you mentioned,
the ghost of Richard Nixon must feel like such a pike.
I've used it like a sort of penny ante sort of sense of exactly. But I mean, so the whole question is then, like, you know, like how does one deal with this? And there's a sort of like, obviously, some Democrats, I think Elizabeth Warren has been at the forefront of this, are raising these issues. But there's a kind of like a school of thought that thinks, well, you know, well, we tried this and it didn't work. Like we impeached Donald Trump twice, and then he got reelected. It's probably better to focus on, you know, sort of bread and butter economic
kitchen table issues. Were you about to say, Jake?
yeah, kitchen table issues, because this is just like clearly the public doesn't care. So, like, what's your sort of like response to that?
My short response is that it's wrong and stupid politics, but I can go into more detail because politics, to quote Henry Adams, who is someone I'm otherwise not a great fan of, but is, as he said, the organization of hatreds. And you have to, you need enemies, you need sort of narratives about bad actors. And what's so frustrating about the Democratic Party's posture right now, you've got these like cartoonish supervillains in the White House. You know, it's not hard to construct these narratives because they're true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's telling, first of all, what began Donald Trump's slide in the opinion polls, obviously things like the disastrous Iran war had accelerated, but it was the destruction of the East Wing of the White House. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that's so palpable. I mean, you've got this Caligulan figure who's enriching himself, and he's literally taking a wrecking ball to the White House. Again, this is a telling flourish of Democratic rhetoric, because at that time they were saying, oh, he's, you know, he's destroying the people's house, which is, in my view, misleading kind of gauzy rhetoric, because the White House was built by slaves. Like, which people are you talking about? And second of all, it, again, like the King's rhetoric, it takes the public's eye off the ball, you know?
Yeah.
What's really happening is this guy is building this insane ballroom, which is like a typical Trump property. It's going to be like gilded, vulgar, you know, it's aesthetically embarrassing and monument to himself.
Oh, yeah.
Everything he's doing with like the Kennedy Center, I mentioned the reflecting pool earlier.
You know, the arch, they're going to have these like kind of circumvent. I mean, it is, you know, at the very least, you know, one would think this is a sort of embarrassing thing that, like, you know, one gets in a tinpot dictatorship where like everything is renamed after the glorious leader, putting his face on the $250 bill.
And the Democrats approach it in this piecemeal way, and they're outraged and they'll issue press releases, but you need a very visceral, and again, I think the ballroom is a powerful symbol in this regard, you know, because a lot of the stuff you talk about, the first term impeachment, you know, people didn't really glom on to the Ukraine payoff. That was the occasion of the first impeachment. It seemed, you know, sort of abstruse in a way that wrecking the White House is not. I mean, it wasn't abstruse because this is, you know, Trump's MO.
So, but they narrowly selected a subject where they thought they could get Republican buy-in, which they got a little bit of, but like not enough to.
Again, a misreading of what the Republican Party has become. It is an authoritarian cult. You're not going to peel off, you know, that ship has sailed. Like all the Never Trumpers have been exiled and repudiated. This whole idea that you're going to pivot towards some mythical middle, sorry, like our politics changed decisively in 2016. You need to just acknowledge that and develop new strategies. So I would say, you know, the tactical error in the first impeachment was not to include the many violations of the Emoluments Clause. Emoluments Clause, again, reflects this founder's extreme solicitude to prevent corruption in the Oval Office, and it involves receiving money and gifts from foreign leaders. And like simple corruption, like you can easily demonstrate it. Everything from, you know, the Trump properties he wants to develop in Saudi Arabia. I mean, we mentioned the crypto thing, the golf courses where, you know, it's so straightforward, so easy. And there's massive public resentment of the ultra wealthy.
Absolutely. I think, like, if we're looking at sort of the mistakes, the first impeachment, it really was like a very narrowly based impeachment designed to, you know, appeal to the sort of national security Republicans, right, and like keeping all the other stuff off the table because, you know, they wouldn't sign on for that. And I don't think it was like worth it to, like, you know, get Liz Cheney or whatever you were thinking of off.
Yeah, course. We have the returns from that experiment.
Right? Yeah. So, but the other aspect I do want to kind of mention, like, to me, this sort of framing of, you know, kitchen table economics versus corruption politics, it's not an either or. And I think the Nixon example that you pointed to, like, gets to that. I mean, I think one reason, like, Watergate took off was not just, like, you know, the tapes and the evidence of corruption, but also that, like, they had tangible effects. This was a time where, because of the oil shock, inflation was taking off. People were paying a lot more money for, like, basic things like, you know, meat and milk. And you have, you know, like, the president, like, oh, yeah, his office, the White House, openly taking money from the milk interest to, like, lift up price controls on milk, which is going to make milk more expensive.
Right.
And joking about it.
In the White House tapes, I mentioned this in the, you know, as we were chatting before, but there's this moment where John Ehrlichman at you know, they all agree, okay, we're going to take this money from milk cooperatives and raise the price of milk. And John Ehrlichman jokes, you know, you better buy a glass of milk now because you're not going to be able to afford it later. And it's just like, oh, you know, yeah, this is why corruption is an effective narrative, because, you know, he's basically saying we're going to twist the knife into the average consumer and we don't care. And that is basically the credo of the Trump White House. And, you know, again, it's a very simple case because the illegal war in Iran has caused gas prices to spike way above what they were at the height of inflation under Biden. And, you know, again, I wrote a piece last year when Trump did his first bombing raid in Iran, I should specify.
Yeah.
The Democrats need to impeach him. This is a clear violation of the Constitution. You know, you don't get these powers back by just sitting on your hands. You have to fight. And, you know, I'm not gloating or anything, but had they done that, had they at least, you know, tried to get Republicans on a vote, you know, to sort of say, do you support this or not, they would be in a much stronger political position now that we are actually in an illegal war with Iran and people are suffering. Democrats could say, look, we tried to tell you, we tried to stop this trade. Instead, you know, you have this fake savvy mentality among Democratic leaders that, like, oh, we can't risk our political capital. We need to wait for midterms. We need to drone away about the table issues. And what's crazy making about that is, first of all, I still don't know what the Democrats' plans for kitchen table issues really are.
Yeah.
We're going to, you know, be more gradual in the formation of the oligarchy. It's very unspecific.
Well, no, I mean, it is a politics, as you said, where you don't name enemies and you don't actually say that they're these people who are, like, getting very rich while everyone else is suffering. But it's, you know, like, the actual reality. I mean, like, it's actually, I mean, Trump in some ways has fallen back into the position of Biden of complaining, well, the stock market is good, why are people complaining? But it's look at polls, like, there's, like, incredible deep economic pessimism, and the discrepancy between, you know, what the stock market thinks and what ordinary people feel is, like, never been wider. And so that does actually point towards the politics of resentment against the rich. And if you actually have, you know, this, like, you know, this guy who's president is basically the monopoly man.
The office in this way. Like, again, this isn't hard. Yeah. You know, this is basic politics. And it's just, yeah, dumbfounding to me, at least, living here in Washington, that, you know, we still have this kind of outmoded 90s era narrative that, you know, we're just going to talk about, you know, protecting people who work hard and play by the rules. And, but, you know, there's no serious discussion of a national billionaire tax. There's no serious discussion of, you know, really making healthcare a durable social good available to all. It's just, you know, a defensive posture at best. And it's also like, okay, we're going to get the House back and we're going to hold a long regress of hearings to generate media coverage. But what's the policy plan? You know, it's telling the one Democratic think tank here in town just produced a Project 2029 as an answer to the Project 2025 that is now being implemented ruinously in the Trump White House. And it's notably short on concrete policy proposals in the sphere of political economy, because our surprise of people who fund Democratic think tanks don't want progressive taxation at a scale that will harm their interests. So again, you're back to the basic problem of recognizing corruption and oligarchy as real and present threats to our democracy. And the Democratic Party is lamentably too slow and too choppy and has its own conflicts of interest.
Yeah, no. I if, well, you know, look, to use a sort of classic economist talk, you know, like you're on a desert island with a tin can. So let's posit a can opener. Let's posit a Democratic Party that actually, you know, did want to challenge us. What would be the actual instruments? Like, let's say, you know, Democrats win back Congress and the Senate. It's a little bit iffy right now, but it could. I think it's actually still very much in the realm of possibility. What do you think they should be doing?
Well, you know, a bunch of stuff that I know they won't want, you know, at the leadership level, they won't want to do. And, but yeah, I mean, I think this is the very staple of issues. You know, if you want to know why you're paying so much for gas and groceries, it's because of the Strait of Hormuz. It's, you know, and it's not just gas and groceries. It's, you know, the farm economy, the economy I grew up in Eastern Iowa, something like 40% of the world's fertilizer goes through the Strait of Hormuz. It's been planting season. All, you know, the long-term impact of this disastrous errand in Iran is going to be really bad economically. And it's, again, not a difficult case to make. It's sitting right there. So yeah, it's this weird moment where there's just this endless loop of rhetoric about kitchen table issues. And it's mostly like we're trying to walk back, you know, the ruinous Medicaid cuts and, you know, restore subsidies under the ACA, which is all good and should happen, absolutely. But you need something much more ambitious. You need to say, like, you know, there should not be billionaires in this country.
So, well, I mean, we had mentioned like impeachment before. And I think one thing maybe to emphasize is, like, doesn't the power of impeachment go beyond the presidency? Like, aren't there like a lot of other like public officials that could in theory be impeached?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Republicans tried to, I guess they won an impeachment vote against Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security under Biden. So, again, you know, yeah, it's a failure of political imagination. I think, you know, I can think of six Supreme Court justices off the top of my head that are sort of prime candidates. You know, the right made a big deal of trying to impeach Earl Warren, and it didn't go anywhere. But you could argue it was effective politics, right?
Yeah, no, it certainly centered the Supreme Court. It was, you know, the beginning of the long project whereby they retook the courts. So
obviously you abolish ICE in my fantasy world. And I mean, that's the other thing is everyone in this administration is corrupt.
Yeah. But I'm sure you like someone like Kash Patel, you know, who's like, I mean, certainly like impeachment hearings about his fitness for office, given all that's been reported about, you know, his frequent inebriation.
I'm spacing on the guy they just now nominated to the DNI, who is spectacularly unqualified. I mean, there's the competence part too, which is relevant.
I think a program of like sort of like mass impeachment hearings is not like unwarranted given who Trump has actually like nominated and has like.
No, I mean, I think it's if you pan back, I think what the Trump MAGA project is this never-ending stress test on being deployed on the institutions of our government. And they're always going to, I mean, January 6th is the locus classicus of this, right? Trump decided, I don't care that I lost the election. I'm going to stir up a mob and I'm going to try to seize power and become a dictator. That was literally the logic behind January 6th. And once, you know, the system did not respond in the way it should have, that opens the door to everything coming in its wake. And I, you know, early on in the second Trump administration, I wrote a column arguing that, you know, January 6th is the model for how Trump is going to rule in the second term. And regrettably, I think I was right. All across the federal bureaucracy, you see the same stress tests, right? You see, we're going to do mass deportation and, you know, use ICE agents to menace both immigrants and protesters, and we don't care. Try to stop us. And, you know, when you speak of corruption, like the Broadview prosecution in Chicago, you know, my wife is a law professor, and she was just reading the details of the effort to get a grand jury indictment out of this thing, and she's very cynical, and it was shocking. Yeah. Like, these people are just apparatchiks of the lowest moral character. And, you know, they're just doing the bidding of the supreme leader.
Yeah. In terms of further responses, like all the sort of people in the Department of Justice who are, like, involved with sort of political prosecution, I know there's discussions of possibly going after Jean Carroll, who had, you know, like won for the crime of, like, you know, like one further response is that, you know, like, if the Democrats come to power, they could say, we will recommend, like, you know, like, anybody who's involved with the political prosecutions of this sort, we're going to recommend to the Bar Association that they be disbarred. We'll hold hearings on that. We'll investigate this. And we will that these people will face like prosecution within their own field, right? Like, you know, for obviously for a lawyer being disbarred is not a great thing. So, there are actually like a lot of different avenues that are like open.
Absolutely, but you need to develop those muscles. You need to actually condition legislators to think in that way, and instead of just saying, oh, you know, kitchen table issues, blah, 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 vote for us in November.
I will mention as a hopeful thing, I mean, like, it was very heartening that on Wednesday, the House, you know, voted on the War Powers Resolution, rebuking the president and calling for the end of the war in Iran. And they got, you know, enough, you know, only four, but that's enough for to sort of pass it.
I think it's also telling, you know, Massey obviously voted because he's anti-war and lame duck, and Trump they hate each other, but the other three were I believe all swing state.
Pennsylvania, I think Davidson is Ohio's not, I mean, arguably, although he's also like anti-war in a sort of massive way. But I mean, it's just, these are all, I mean, that's the, it's a center, you know, to use the right wing rhetoric, that this is the heartland of America, right, the real Americans are. And guess what? They don't like,
yeah, they're not worse.
I think the War Powers Resolution, like, is going to bring up interesting constitutional issues, because there is, you know, like, the vice president has basically said the War Powers Resolution is a fake and unconstitutional.
Right.
And I think that's a reference to, I believe, the sort of Chadha decision of 1983, which held that sort of like legislative concurrence, where you get the House and Senate to vote on something, and that can override presidential action. The Supreme Court has said that's not constitutional, but then there's further questions whether Chadha applies to the War Powers Resolution, which at the time, I believe even Lewis Powell, who voted for Chadha, said it did not. And so this is actually going to be a real constitutional issue. And I think that it's not necessarily one where Democrats can win with the Supreme Court, but I actually also think that it's actually worth, like, you know, making it raises the stakes. And it, as he's like,
even if you don't win, again, you fight, you create a record, you sort of get the administration lackeys like Vance on the record to parrot these lines over and over again, and they become more bolder.
Yeah, because I actually don't think that, like, the majority of Americans would be are happy with a system where any president can declare war at any time without, right.
And we're seeing what comes of that in real time.
Yeah. And,
you know, it is not, whatever else you want to call it, it's it's not a republic or a democracy.
No. I mean, I actually think on the war powers, like we are kind of heading for a constitutional crisis of some sort, because obviously to some degree, like, you know, I have the apologies to your wife is a legal expert, but I have a cynical view that I think a lot of this is sort of priestly post-facto justifications of what people want. But still, like, to the extent that there's anything that's very clear-cut in the Constitution, it's very clear-cut that the power to declare war belongs to Congress.
There's no, you know, I wrote about this last year for Harper's, that, you know, and I went back and reread the Federalist stuff. And it's also the history of the War Powers Act is also really instructive, because it was largely triggered by the, again, Nixon did the same thing in Cambodia. And Liz Holtzman, who later became a key figure in Watergate prosecution, had, you know, decided we're going to draft legislation to reassert Congress's sovereignty in this matter. And it sort of went to the Supreme Court at the time. And Bill Douglas, the Supreme Court justice, issued a stay on the bombing in Cambodia pending the court's ultimate. And he said something to the effect of, like, you know, I have to do this because otherwise innocent people are going to be killed. Which, let's just say, that was a very different Supreme Court.
Very different Supreme Court. Yeah. But I still think, even, you know, in a hostile court, it's actually worth, you know, like, having these sort of fights about,
again, this is all about narratives and creating a record, right? Yeah. You just have to, you know, you're not going to win them all, but you have to go in and wage these battles. And, you know, in point of fact, any member of Congress can introduce an impeachment resolution at any time. So you've had, you know, congressmen like Al Green and the guy in Michigan who are, you know, was doing it cynically because he's got a left-wing primary opponent, but whatever, I don't care. And you just generate voice votes, you get more people each time you do it, and you get Republicans on the record defending an indefensible presidency. This is what I don't understand. Like, and it's not like Congress is doing anything anyway, right?
No.
Like, use this power. You know, it's right there. So yeah, it's baffling to me, except it's of a piece with what you were describing as the priestly procedural. You know, they have this idea like, oh, we can't go outside the norms ever.
No. But I mean, I think, you know, I mean, we're already far outside the norms in the sense of, you know, like the Trump presidency, like the Nixon presidency before, is a constitutional crisis. And, you know, like the question is to get an opposition that's willing to fight on these kind of like existential grounds.
Right.
And articulate existential.
Again, as you were saying earlier, like this false distinction between kitchen table issues and the imperial presidency, you know, right now we are seeing, again, like the recklessness of the imperial presidency is what's driving the cost of living up.
Yeah.
So every time Democrats sort of say, we're not going there because of this, they are missing the crucial connection that people recognize. Again, it's the White House ballroom wrecking ball. It's the, you know, Kennedy Center BS. And it's all of this. You know, he's literally just building these kind of late Roman monuments to himself. The Republic is collapsing. You know, I feel like Clapham or someone here, but it's true. Like, you know.
I think that, you know, it should not be hard to run against President Caligula. But on that note, we could end for today, but I'm sure we'll carry on the discussion in the future. I want to thank once again Chris Lehman, my colleague at The Nation, and I'll link to his article on the Anti-Weaponization Fund, which I would encourage people to read as a sort of excellent example of the folly of empire. Thank you once again, Chris.
Thank you, Jade. Always a pleasure.
The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI? Or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.